Welcome, everybody, to a new episode of Future Bites. I'm your host, Gabriele Corcos. We are in New York City, Penn Plaza, right above the Madison Square Garden, on stage 17 at the Hackensack Meridian Health Stage in the Cumulus Media Studios. Future Bites is this strange cross between tech and food, where those two entities meet. What's happening? How is shaping the world of the things that we eat and the future? What's the future in the kitchen? How and what will you eat in the future? Today with me, today's ladies, so it's like being at home with my wife and two girls. So I feel very comfortable. Thank you so much for being here. We have Robin Shapiro, co-founder of Sick Food, and Berta Jimenez. You created Rise. So you both... we're talking about alternative proteins today. We're talking about alternative ingredients and how we can kind of like break a few barriers and start thinking about not just sustainability, but the fact, as far as I am concerned, that the overpopulation of this planet deserves ways to make life a little bit more sustainable. So we are not here to tell you that you need to ditch your steak. We're here to tell you that you need to ditch your $8 steak, because that is... not sustainable ingredient. The good steak should be $60, $70. You have it once a month, once every other month. But for the most part, I do see the world taking a different direction. I see chefs and regular people more interested in alternative proteins. And is, I mean, I had crickets with you already. I made pasta with you. And actually, my recipe is going to be on your book. So, but I have to say something before I let you talk. Sorry. Years ago, I was in Houston, and I did have my first tacos with crickets. I consider that to be more of a Texan experiment, something that really was not bound to enter my life or to change my life in any way. Plus, I got a little sick from it, so kind of like I blamed the crickets right away, and I never came around it. Then I met you. And I have to say that when I met you, the resistance on the ingredient, at least on my part, was huge. I was very happy that you connected with one of my producers and you arrived on the show. But I'm a little bit of a prick when it comes to the food. I'm extremely judgmental. And there's nothing makes me more happy than have you here again, because I liked what I ate. And for the people that know me, everybody knows that I'm a carnivore. I like to make fun of vegans and vegetarians, you know, with a good heart. Never too aggressive. But I am getting to the point where I am embracing this shift in culture. I do believe that is extremely interesting and bound to a degree to save the world. So I would like to start with you, Robin. Oh, first of all, Robin, why don't you introduce yourself, and then we pass it to Miss Jimenez, and then we... Sorry, Miss Jimenez?
Jimenez.
Oh, okay, sorry. This is the battle of the accent here. Okay, so Robin, tell me about your company.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, that introduction. And I guess I didn't realize that you went through such a transition from, you know, resistance from a way that, you know, not everyone has. Like, you actually had a bad experience as opposed to people just saying, like, you know, being a little bit culturally adverse to eating crickets and other insects.
Yeah, it was
like a bad experience to the whole sort of 180.
Well, you know, it's not that the first time that you get drunk is like you never drunk. You're never going to drink again.
Good point.
Certain things are worth trying again.
Good point.
Always.
Yeah. So my name is Robin, as you've sort of introduced me. My company Seek, we make different snacks and foods with cricket protein. So we started with making granola and energy bites, and really, as a culinary driven brand, you know, we believe in having it all. We should have food that is really nutritious, really sustainable, but we shouldn't sacrifice taste in any of that.
What made you think about crickets? Did you do your research, or did you try different ingredients before landing on, before you chose it as your protein? What was the process to get there for you?
Well, I've always been passionate about food, and I found myself in the center of Europe. I was living in Switzerland. I was put there for a job, and I was traveling very frequently between Switzerland, France, and Italy, the bordering countries. Like, this is food mecca of the world.
I mean, but no crickets, really.
But I'm you know,
only a night.
It started from being in those places and really just understanding how sustainability was so closely intertwined with food. It was just really baked into the culture there in a way that we didn't have back here in America.
Well, that is actually a conversation that we end up touching on many episodes, and it always comes around, is the fact that here in America we are in the land of the everything. Mm-hmm. We like having everything accessible. That generates a little, you know, an incredible footprint in terms of pollution, but also this idea that whatever you need is always accessible. In Europe, I grew up experiencing a deep connection with the land where you eat, where you live. So you go to the butcher, most likely you have seen that cow somewhere as you're driving around the fields. You go to the vegetable stand, you know where those vegetables are coming. Here in the United States, you have the 24/7 kind of supermarkets where that it's not that perception is altered; it just doesn't exist. It's just a matter of convenience.
And you're eating all the cuts of the cow too.
Exactly. And this actually brings me to introduce you, Bertha, because that excessive consumption generates leftovers. Consumption in general generates leftovers, but there are people like you that are able. Let's say you are, to me, Italians make wine, and with what is left with the grapes, they make grappa. Nothing gets lost. People here make beer, and then what do you do after? Tell us about yourself.
Sure. Should I intro?
Yeah, a little bit.
So, hi, I'm Berta Jimenez. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Rise, and we're of the food tech startup that takes organic byproducts and convert it into ingredients. And, yeah, the first industry is beer. And it didn't start like us thinking about we would make beer into food, because our backgrounds, my team is mainly mechanical engineers, math, mm-hmm. computer science, and somebody from business. So what was like driving us was like how we can make cities more, like how can we make cities better? And we believe in this concept called industrial symbiosis. Mm-hmm. That means the byproduct of a company can become the raw material of another company.
Okay.
So we met when we were like doing our grad school. And then we started looking, okay, what's going on in the city that we're living, which is New York City. And there was already a lot of infrastructures for plastic, plastic metal.
Right, recycling.
Yeah, recycling. But there was nothing, but there was like the forgotten waste, which was food waste. And then we were like started looking, okay, what is like a homogeneous source of food waste? And it came from the beer industry.
Something that is constant, where you know what to expect in terms of output.
Yes.
Restaurants, you never know what to expect in their garbage, obviously.
So it was like the craft brewery was like New York City, it was growing, and it was just not New York City. It was like all the urban environments, not just in the United States, but everywhere. So then what happened is like we thought that we just like kind of like make a marketplace and exchange the byproducts. But then when we took the byproduct, which is a spent grain, which is just malted barley mm-hmm. that has been boiled and crushed, we realized the materiality of this, like it spoils super quickly. You know, like the texture is a little bit funky, you know, and because we're not from the food industry, we start like just testing it. So actually at the beginning, we make paper, we make soap, we make cosmetics, we make enzymes, you know, name it. We ate it, we didn't die.
Oh gosh, that's good that you're still here for us.
Yes, I'm still here. We ate it for 2-3 months, you know, and trying different things. And none of, like, I don't cook, you know, I just like put like some
right.
stuff. So then we understood that the beauty of this particular material was that it has high nutrition and like high fiber, high protein, and low carbohydrates. And that also was like, there was a lot of it. So we were like talking with the breweries, and they were telling us like most of the people in the cities, initially they were trying to give it to the farmers, mm-hmm. but because they have to pay for tolls and they have to pay it,
they just decided to dispose it.
Like the best chance they compost it, but 80% they dispose it.
It's interesting because now here we have somebody that is able, that has found a food source that was unexpected and reinvented it or tooled on it. And then we have somebody like you, Robin, that just found a different source altogether, but it's an alive source. And it's interesting to me because on one side you have the animal kingdom where all of a sudden that protein is readily available, but I also like the fact that there is that scaling down, biomass, if you want to call it, of products that are being used, but they do still have that opportunity to provide nutrients.
Yes.
Do you see that the nutrients, though, get... Let's talk about nutrients, about the difference between your product, the kind of... So, let me finish first. You make flour out of that, right?
Yes, because we're engineers.
Okay.
What was better for us was to create a process and create an ingredient where then, like, the experts, like the chef, like the food manufacturers, like the bakers, they can, like so we create, like, the canvas, and then you experiment with it.
That's kind of like what you're doing, Robin, with the crickets. How do you make how does cricket flour comes around?
Yeah, and crickets really are an ancient food. They're the first food that we've been eating. So it's new here in Western countries and here in the U.S., but it's something that is currently consumed at so many different nations from around the world. So insects are consumed in over 80% of the world's nations. So over 2 billion people right now
are eating
insects as a form of their diet.
What are their favorite insects, do you know?
Crickets specifically are popular in places like Mexico, parts of Africa, parts of Asia. Mm-hmm. And I personally have experimented eating a lot of different insects, but crickets, there is a supply chain developed for them. There's awareness growing for them, and they don't have such a sort of cultural aversion.
Why do you think they were selected rather than any other bug, really? Because of their nutrients or because it's easier to raise them or... Did you say raise crickets or grow crickets?
Yeah, farm them. Yeah,
to farm them. Kind of like more of a neutral name.
Right. A few of the reasons that I said, given that there is a supply chain there, that they are easier to farm. So just like I'm an entrepreneur doing this, a lot of the farmers out there are as well. They are sort of really nutritious.
So what's the process? So you raise the crickets.
Yeah, so the crickets are raised, and I'm working with farmers who are raising them, farmers from around the world. Right now, our crickets are coming from a farm in Texas and a farm in Mexico.
Okay.
The farmers raise them. They have about a six-week lifespan, and then they are sort of dried and then milled up into a powder form. It's a very sort of...
Is it a job that you do, or they do it for you?
They do it for me, and it's a very sort of minimally...
It's just a mechanical process.
It is
not, flushing, washing, all that kind of stuff.
No, it's really straightforward, and I've done it at home myself.
I mean, probably some washing before you grind them. But,
Of course. Yeah, they should go through a little rinse. Then it is a very sort of, simplified process. And that's how we believe in eating. And we believe in eating from the earth, eating foods that we've been eating, since humankind's been around. And actually, something interesting is our body is actually engineered to eat insects. So we have 5 dormant genes that are in us.
Yeah, we're nice omnivores. We can eat basically
for
everything.
For breaking down the exoskeleton, that we don't use anymore because we're not breaking down the exoskeleton when we're eating.
Okay.
But we have... we're sort of engineered.
At some point, in evolution. When do you think that was over?
Well, it's still going on today.
I mean, people that have these ingredients in the diet, for sure, are still using those enzymes.
Yeah.
They're clearly able to digest them properly.
And you mentioned sort of, flowers and what we're doing together.
Yes, right?
I think it's exciting to tell people what we're doing. So because we've always wanted to work closer with chefs and bakers, the one responsible for cooking delicious food, what we've heard over the years is that they wanted to kind of take our products a step further and work more with crickets. So we're launching a line of baking flours.
Fantastic.
An all-purpose one, a gluten-free one, a paleo one, and then just a pure cricket powder. And chefs like you and chefs from around the nation and a few international ones as well.
So you have obviously
a recipe to a cookbook.
What is the percentage of cricket flour in the flour itself?
So it differs. Obviously, we have one that's a 100% pure powder, so that's 100%.
What do you do with that?
So, for instance,
Creaker muffins.
You asked how long that it's been here for. So one of the contributing chefs is a guy named Sean Sherman, the Sui chef. Amazingly talented chef looking to raise awareness about indigenous foods here in America and really all down through Central America, too. So when I said to Sean, I said, hey, which flour do you want to use? And he's like, we wouldn't use any of your flours. That's not what we used as part of indigenous cuisine. So he used just the protein. He actually mixed it with a masa flour and made this insanely delicious bison tamale that also has some like sort of squash and it's so we just shot the sort of first recipes for the cookbook. I need to show
Fantastic.
You your recipe which
please,
we shot
cannot wait.
Yeah, your
but this is
pasta.
A this is a matter of culture, right? There is that kind of barrier that you have to break when you're introducing ingredients that are really not something that you see in books. I'm like, you know, telling my kids that I ate cricket flour because they do know the cricket. They were like, oh, no. And I'm like, trust me. Like, you know, one day I'll make you try it.
Did they ever have it?
No, not yet. Not yet. But I made fresh bread with the flour you gave me.
Oh, good.
And I didn't tell them. I told them it was whole wheat. And they made sandwiches and nobody died.
Did
and everybody
you ever
happy.
Tell them? They still don't know today?
No, they still don't know.
You should get your kids on the show.
I should, yeah.
Big reveal.
Try them. Yeah, one day I will. When it comes to your product, what is after you get the process, you know, the thing that is interesting to me is that you do know what to expect because you work with certain kind of breweries. How does it change it when a brewery makes a different kind of beer? What is the expectations that you have out of the product?
So beer is like you put malted barley, you boil it like it's a tea. Then the tea, it's later on the wort that's fermented, the hops and everything else. But this like extra, you know, mash, that's what we take.
Mm-hmm.
So all the beers, 85% of them, it doesn't matter if it's a porter or it's a pilsner, they're all the same. Because most of the flavors are put afterwards.
Okay.
And so 85% is like the base malt, it's a two-row base malt.
Right.
And the 15%, that's where like they put like more roasted, so that's when it's more roasted.
Yeah, they blend
stout.
The hops and all that kind
no,
of
no,
stuff.
No,
yeah.
The hops is later.
Oh, okay, okay.
So we don't deal with the hops.
Okay.
We deal with
just the first stage, okay.
Just the first stage.
Okay.
So that's why like when like the light one, which is from IPAs, ales, and pilsners, we know how to mix them to have a light line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a nutty, almondy flavor profile. Well, the dark ones, it's like from porters and stouts, and it doesn't matter who is brewing. We just like it's a matter of understanding the grain build. So it's a lot of data that we have collected in order to build on a specific recipe to produce a dark flour.
If you wanted to convince me to use it, what would be the strongest point, your selling point?
So actually, it depends who we talk. There are people that are interested in local.
Mm-hmm.
So all the breweries that we're working, we collected from breweries in Queens and Brooklyn.
Okay.
And then we move this material less than a couple miles, and we do it with our proprietary technology.
Okay.
So like, if you're interested in how local it is, it's super local. It's super sustainable. If you're interested in the nutrition, this compares to the normal flour, 12 times the fiber, 2 times the protein, and 1/3 of the carbs.
It's a very rich one. Okay.
Yes.
I imagine for the both of you, there has to be a little bit of a learning curve in terms of like learning how to place your product on the market. It is not just the intent of doing something that is good for this planet, but you got to pay your bills and live as well while you do that. What are the hurdles? Or how do you get certified? How do you bring a product like this? You know, you come up with the idea. You refine your product, and in both instances, is an exceptional product. People reception and people perception about it is one thing, but what about the bodies that govern your ability to distribute and sell it? So any certification isn't necessary, or did you have to have your mix analyzed by anybody before you put it into commerce? And what are the biggest hurdles to get into commerce?
Yeah, so I mean, we have had to do testing, but that testing isn't unique to you know, our brand. It's just for any food brand.
Absolutely.
So we sort of do different, you know, pH testing to sort of make sure, you know, water levels will below a certain point, to talk about shelf life. You know, all of our products are gluten-free. So sort of that's, you know, verified. In terms of, and maybe if this is what you were getting at, in terms of, you know, what is the sort of regulatory stance on crickets, because that is such a new ingredient.
Yes.
You know, we do fall under the USDA.
Okay.
And, you know, they have, you know, we've been sort of in conversations. I say we as like an industry, we have a sort of nonprofit governing body.
Absolutely.
Around increasing our consumption of crickets. And they've said as long as this is sort of intended as food, intended for sort of human consumption, then
well, I would
okay
assume that
marketed.
The farms that you're buying from are already to a degree certified to
yeah, it's
give
a weird
that ingredient
sort of
to you,
gray
right?
area answer that we're getting from them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is specific to the U.S. In Europe, actually, things work a little bit differently.
Okay.
And different countries are taking a little bit longer to sort of, you know, certify this as food. And
have you encountered any problems so far, or it has been somewhat of a streamlined process for you from inception to packaging and making it available?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely loads of challenges.
Oh, well, you know.
But in terms of this category of what we're speaking of, this, you know, there hasn't been any major hurdles here.
Okay.
Other ones, though, but not here.
And Berta, what for you?
So similar as Robin said, like from the beginning, because we even like when we started like making a lot of like we're super research oriented. So we started testing with labs, like we have like tests of everything, pathogens, allergens, nutritional profile.
Mm-hmm.
There's really like nothing about this particular thing because it's new. So, but what we do is like we control everything from the moment. So it comes out of a boiler.
Mm-hmm.
We put it to food grade beans.
Mm-hmm.
And then we bring it to our facility.
Okay.
So we're like doing like even like more than will normally be asked.
Well, given that the product has been boiled already, so that there is a certain kind of safety that comes with that.
Yeah.
And then obviously,
it's in a safe, you know, like it's in a boiler. So it's like a food grade system.
What's people's perception about your product?
You know, in New York City, people are very open because they find fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
We just got an article last Monday from New York Times.
Okay, congrats.
Thank you. So actually, our sales has like gone super high.
Oh, look at that. You're almost blushing. I'm Esther Hewitt.
So it has been like going super high. Like, you know, like, so it's like it seems like it's like something that everybody appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have like a lot of interest from people from Europe saying like, hey, we have like this brewery. Can you help us install a system that can, and also like.
I almost see breweries being able to develop an extra product because, you know, given that they do have it, you know, you can do your own, but you also can consult and help them.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's our idea also because like, you know, we're just one small startup, you know.
Well, plus it depends. If you really think of yourself more as an engineer,
yes,
you're really providing a solution more for them than for the general public. Like you were able to tackle a problem, which was what to do with this kind of waste. If you don't want to be the one that does it for everybody and puts it in stores, you can surely go to every single brewery and implement all the research that you have done to allow them to, you know, extend their offerings.
So actually we tell the breweries, you are not in the beer industry, you are in the grain industry.
Yeah.
So like some people like do want to like do their extra things. And because we're interested in industrial symbiosis per se,
mm-hmm.
our process also works with other industries. So actually we could also help the juice industry. Like even the wine.
Well, wine for sure.
Wine, the distilleries, the sake, the soy milk. So anything that has a similar physical characteristic.
Are you saying that you're already working on other projects aside from this one?
Yes. Our process also works with others, and we're already experimenting with this.
Give me one example that to you is extremely exciting.
Well, I'm excited about, like, we're working also, like, with seeds from oil. So, like, the byproduct of seeds
mm-hmm.
is like a cake.
Okay.
And it has really, really interesting, like, proteins. And also, like, another one is the juice, which it has, like, it's very nice also for cosmetic applications.
How do you get the juice? Like,
the juice pulp.
Oh, the juice pulp. Okay.
The juice pulp.
But how do you harvest that? You need to go through, like, places that make juices?
Yes.
Oh,
so
gosh.
We always work with the, like, we don't do anything. Like, make right. the people that have like already this waste, we take that.
So you basically created a chart of the kind of food waste, the kind of ingredients, and see what you could do with yes. those different categories.
Yes.
What do you do with the pulp? Like cosmetics, you said, creams?
You can do, like, you can make like a skincare applications, mm-hmm. but it's also good, like, even like for like an ingredient for your cake, you know, to have flavor, to have like the vitamin C or whatever. So each one has will have different characteristics in terms of nutrition and what we'll have.
That to me is incredibly interesting. You know, one of the things that I think is obviously necessary is create the content that is the digestible, so to speak, to people that are still not necessarily close to the subject. Robin, where do you see us being more efficient? What is the ideal target to talk about these products? This is not about changing minds. This is about adding an offering and showing people how you can eat consciously and really have less impact on your planet because of the way that you eat. What is the best way to get to people's hearts and minds when it comes about these thoughts? And also, you got to convince them that, you know, cricket flour is good. I'm telling you, it is good. Like, I like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really does come down to change. You know, something that we've always been told is being challenged.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't something that here in America people have grown up eating. So, you know, it takes people a second to think about that, to do something different. And we want to make that process for them as easy and as joyful as possible. So that's why we think about everything that contributes to that. Our, you know, people are oftentimes calling out our package design and, you know, how that sort of, you know, sparks and resonates with them. And then this next evolution of the brand, and this is really inspired by, you know, Dan Barber and his book, The Third Plate, mm-hmm. If you've read that, and
yeah.
is understanding how we can forge partnerships closer with chefs.
Absolutely.
You know, you have a, you know, amazing sort of opportunity to, you know, influence how people eat from a nutrition and a sustainability standpoint, as well as, you know, you have your own unique perspective and history on it.
I think, you know, sometimes this came to mind because I was talking to my kid today about you and about the episode that I was about to record. And because she has seen the package of your flour at home, and because we have met and worked already together, she kind of like gets it. But she keeps on resisting. She keeps on saying, I will never do that. And ultimately, I think that aside from the education factor, you just need to find people that are really hungry. Because I hate to say it, but, you know, I told my girl, like, you're, you know, a lucky white girl that never got hungry. You've never been really hungry in your life. That kind of hungry that brings you to open a garbage can. That kind of like, I'm about to pass out, or give me whatever there is. And that conversation wouldn't happen if you felt that way. I get the goosebumps when I think about it, because in my life I probably ate out of a garbage twice, and I was camping. So it's not that my life depended on it, but I do know what does it mean I cannot function anymore. I am at the end.
Totally. Yeah, there's a much larger picture here of global sustainability and sort of the implications on that level as populations are rising. You know, as our reliance on meat and actually increase in meat consumption just isn't sustainable, the math doesn't work out from sort of land usage, not to mention the fact that meat is contributed to the leading cause of death in America, cardiovascular
disease. Oh, absolutely.
Disease.
You know, and the pollution, the CO2 pollution,
and
methane
pollution. Yeah, you know. Crickets don't release, you know, any sort of, you know, greenhouse gases, or maybe a very tiny amount as compared to meat. We're working with a few different nonprofits. We're a member of 1% for the Planet, and one of them is an amazing nonprofit called Farms to Orphans, and mm-hmm. they actually are working on increasing insect consumption in orphanages across Africa.
Wow.
Because malnutrition is a major issue in these orphanages.
It
is. The food that they're receiving is little to no food slash
I mean,
stuff that
look,
isn't nutrient dense.
We live in New York
abundant.
City, and one kid in four kids goes to bed hungry. It's New York City. We think we have it all. It's New York fucking City, and we are on top of the world. One of the things that I always say is that, well, you know, we don't talk about it because it's hidden, because you don't see it, because the crying hungry kid is not in front of your face where you feel compelled to act upon it. And the same goes for as far as my experience with meat. I grew up in Tuscany. I always knew where my meat came from. When I moved to California, all of a sudden, I did not have farms around. I did not have land around. It took me a drive from Los Angeles to San Francisco on the I-5 and spent, what is that, 200, 250 miles of brown manure and cows rolling in mud because they're just eating grains. There's no trees, there's no grass. Those are the steaks that you find at your regular 24/7 store. But then if you drive back from San Francisco to Los Angeles and you want to do the scenic route, then you are, you know, by the coast, there are the pastures, there's fewer cows, but those are the $60 steaks. And that, I think, in my life, and it happened about 10 years ago, the moment in which I was like, there's something wrong in the way that I consume my meat. I have to abandon completely. Cheap meat is not sustainable. Cheap meat should not exist. Does not exist.
Many different foods out there, you know, you're not going to have it be cheap without major, major sacrifices.
Exactly.
We know that from cheap meat. And that is one of the benefits of crickets. You know, cricket operations can be scaled up so that the as the industry grows, you know, prices will come down without sacrificing that quality.
And for you too, Bertha,
really
right? Like you can scale up and find, you know, not just the breweries, but, you know, when you really think about the byproduct of the industries, there are like infinite numbers, you know, I hate calling it garbage. But it's leftovers. It's stuff that nobody else wants.
Yeah, food waste is a major issue.
Yeah. Let's just think about the beer. There's 42 million tons in the world that sent to the landfill. That's, you know, if we send it, transform that to food, that's the whole population of South America, you know, where I'm from, that you can feed.
That's insane.
And it's just one of the industries, you know? So that's the thing. Like, we also, like, currently we're doing, like, pretty manual, but we know how to scale. It's just like we're raising funding in order to scaling. And then we can, like, really go down with the price.
Right.
So it's and also, like, when we're, like, thinking about,
when do you,
like,
think that will happen? Not for you business-wise, but when do you think that the
What the problem is? The problem is that people think here in the United States, it's different in every country, but people think agriculture and agricultural equipment should be out of the city.
Right.
Actually, if we have access to agricultural equipment in the city, it will be really fast.
Absolutely.
Because that's the type of equipment that we're needing. So even like to have access to a mill. You cannot have access to a meal, like, easily.
Well, you know, I think that life is changing. You know, 2 decades ago, when the farm that I grew up started losing workforce because the sons and the daughters of the farmers decided that they wanted to go to university and better their lives, in a sense, like, stop working the land and have more opportunities to a degree. We all ran to the city. The city became the core of being functional. The, you know, a lot of people together generate a lot of ideas. It's a better place for everybody to thrive, business-wise, emotion-wise. But at the same time, now it has become a luxury to be able to get out of the city, unplug from the chaos, and reconnect to really where you come from. In general, as a human being, as your place in the world.
Yeah,
so.
But manufacturing should be back to the cities. Manufacturing shouldn't be like something that should be like far away. Like manufacturing is the backbone.
I do understand, but how do you tell New Yorkers that they need to build a factory in Manhattan? You know what I mean? You know, a lot of cities, I'll give you an example, like Florence, the city where I grew up, is a city where you just cannot do anything. It's, you know, it's an historical center.
Yeah.
It's really hard to bring, you know, there was a reason. You know, you can bring manufacturing inside the city, that is true, but then you need the tolls and highways to move trucks in and out. There is so much that happens.
Yeah, but there's something that, for instance, like, it doesn't have to be heavy manufacturing. So,
right.
For instance, like, actually New York City is giving incentives. So, like, we are looking to move towards the Brooklyn Army Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
So, even like, you know, moving this, you can use like smaller equipment. You
Absolutely.
Don't need to have like the bigger equipment, but you can have like, you don't need to like exactly replicate what is outside.
Right, absolutely.
So you can adapt it. And there's like, I think there's place in the city. It's just that people sometimes it's hard to think about it. And that's why, like, New York City actually is giving incentives to make it seen. So instead of, like, this, for instance, the byproduct of this travel up to 600 miles.
Wow.
It can, we don't have landfills anymore, you know? It can travel 6 miles.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, that's the way you can, like...
Well, and then if you're able to implement something like that directly inside the brewery, then you do it, like, on the spot. And then from there, you use the same routes and the same
distribution
they would use.
Yes. Well, depends on the kind of brewery. Like, it's a super small one, no,
right.
But, like, it's a big one. Yes, you can do it, actually, inside the brewery.
Absolutely.
And, like, then they are in the grains... In the grain business, they are not in the beer business.
That is true. We are at the end of our episodes. I would like, first of all, to thank you so much. But I would like some closing remarks. So, hopes and challenges in, you know, for yourself, but also for the industry in general. What you would like to see happen, the kind of change that you hope for, and the obstacles that you see in front of it.
I was talking with one of my investors recently, and he was just saying, Robin, you know, this is something that is going to take time, but it's going to happen. And I need you to do everything you can to stick with this. And I said, I feel a responsibility to humanity for this. And I fear for a world where not only with what I'm doing with crickets, but I think what you're doing is tremendous, tackling food waste. I'm scared for a world without initiatives like this, and crickets pose an incredible opportunity. They're the most sustainable type of food, the most nutritious and abundant. They grow on their own. You know, they're not even a byproduct. They're right there. So I think my challenge is just to continue to, you know, pay close attention to the market, to our customers, to perceptions, and just to stay with it.
You go, girl.
Thanks.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
I really love your product, and I am sure you'll be successful. And for you, Berta, hopes and challenges for what you're doing or your industry in general?
Sure. So one of the hopes is, like, one of the, like, the good things we are seeing is that, for instance, we are working with big food manufacturers, and they are looking for upcycling ingredients. So it's great that they are interesting more about sustainability and nutrition and less about, like, just bringing, like, not good food to the people.
Right.
So that's great. A challenge is, like, for instance, some of them, they want to have, like, a ton per month. We don't have that capacity. Right. So it's manufacturing, as I say, that's a challenge to, like, how you can, like, produce more because it's already there, you know.
It's funny because, like, you create a demand and demand is already above what you can produce.
Yeah.
It's almost like a catch-22, but the good thing is that at least it's happening, right?
Yes.
The feedback is good. Well, ladies, like, you're a force. I'm really happy that the future of Mikey's and the next generations lies on your shoulders to a degree.
No pressure.
No pressure whatsoever. Go ahead, push hard to change the world for us. Make it a better place for everybody. Best of luck. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Future Bites with us from Stage 17 at Comus Media. We say goodbye until the next episode of Future Bites. I'm Gabriele Corcos, and Robin and Berta, thank you so much again. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks.